Thank you very much. I also am saying nothing about ethics, especially not about bioethics. But I am also building, as it happens, the Lord's overruling, on what Mark has said in several respects, as you will see. I will operate from over here, try not to block people in the corner. So, is the image of God in our genes, or, as some believe, in transmitted through our culture, and particularly through traditional family life, or are neither the genes nor our subcultures sufficient for the image of God to be inherited? Similarly, or very differently, do we transmit sin to our descendants through the genes, or through society, human society, or are our lives pervasively corrupted through what we each make of both our genetic inheritance and also our social inheritance? My answer is, of course, the third possibility in each case. Neither, I believe, the image of God nor original sin, in the technical term, is born or conceived in us only. It's no more born and conceived in us, then, I believe, then we are brought up in both. Each is both a genetically and culturally inherited capacity, like all natural capacities, including these distinctively human ones. I should say briefly where I'm coming from. I regard myself as a thoroughly biblical scientist, which means I'm theistic, but also naturalistic in my understanding of what the Bible teaches. And I don't believe in mere complementarity between science and faith, or mind and brain for that matter, but both are books that we read which teach us in what's been called the Hebraic ontology rather than Hellenistic ontology, in that there is one single creation, but God has created different systems, different causal networks within this system, within this one reality, and this view contradicts non-reductive physicalism, let alone classical materialism. It contradicts all dualisms. There are different systems. There's the material system, like the human brain, in the case of human life. There's the cultural system, the social systems, institutions, language, and the rest. And the global village is a continuously creating part of that. And there's God's personal creation, each individual's human life, including the lives, the spiritual lives of the believers. And this has implications for determinism and so forth. So halfway through well, not quite halfway, but some way into my talk, my structure is to talk first about the image, second about sin, and to take the Bible, and then to take science. And my methodology is, to quote a recent book's title, Always Reforming. We keep going back to the Bible. We learn from theologians' work over the centuries, and we also listen to the experts in various fields, including, of course, science outside theology, and we put these together. So we can ask the Bible scholars, the Old Testament scholars, whether what the Bible teaches about human beings' likeness to God and dissimilarities from animals. And we don't learn much, the scholars, most of them, are saying these days. We have the word, which is translated image, which is the same word as often used for idol, and all it means is that we're unlike God in being limited in time and space. And many scholars think that what the likeness is not specified in the context, and it may be more to do with extra-biblical contrasts that the writer is using the word. Biblical theologians have these days, many of them concluded that the passage continuing about our rule of creation, vice regency, is what it's about, kingship, the royal interpretation. But that leaves the problem, what sort of king is God that we're like? Is it an arbitrary despot or what? My answer is it's the king of love that we're made like, who's a king of a people who loves to give justice, security, prosperity among his people. He's not a judge over the whole universe. A king decides amongst the people and defends the people. And the scientists, Mark has been building from neuroscience. I'm going to build in exactly the same direction about the image of God and indeed sin as a psychologist, and tell you about the mechanisms that psychologists now are beginning to find which are unique to contemporary human beings. This isn't evolutionary work at all, as indeed Mark was emphasizing. He's just looking at how things are now, and it also shows likenesses to God as we know God in Christ. So I'm not going to speculate on how we're like God. I'm going to find out from the Bible and from science how we are unlike other contemporary species. When Damien Hirst showed his obscene platinum skull covered with diamonds, the obscenity of it was his asking price, which is $120 million. someone might well have uttered the expletive, "For the love of God, Damien, what have you done now?" He comments on the Christian skull. This is a comment on the tie-up in which he's deeply implicated between art and money. he makes Christian references or biblical cultural references, and he's no doubt aware of the catechism that we are made to love God and serve him. I forget the exact quote. And of course we are made by the love of God, and I'm suggesting that we are made like God in our love. So first the Bible on the image of God. the Locus Classicus is of course Genesis 1, 26 to 28, and I'll go through that. The first thing everybody notes is that the word used for God here is the plural word, Elohim, and indeed the translation faithfully says, "Let us make humanity." The one God says, "Let us make humanity, let them be in our image and likeness," which for Christians clearly prefigures the Trinity, and the loving nature of God himself. It's inherently social love. The eternal lovers are Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and they create and sustain a planet, they, full of lovers just like God, except we are mortal. Next passage, God's mortal image here on this planet is male and female and procreative, and so the biological foundation of the family is part of the creation of humanity. But also, the creation mandate is to rear children so that they become loving adults within a society that runs the earth. In God's original intention and in his final purpose, in the power of Christ's Spirit. So there's a created social foundation of the global village and the rest of the good things we can do to deal with the problems created by sin in the power of Christ's Spirit and in virtue of the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. So, like God, the image of God is plurality in unity. From the biological point of view, a man will be united to his wife, and with the help of God, says the woman, I have brought forth a man. But the picture we're given also shows that woman is taken out of man, as we now know in cellular and molecular detail. Socially, also, there's plurality and unity. The man had no suitable partner until the Lord God brought the woman to him, and the other way around too. In the middle of the garden, her husband was with the woman. So biologically, there's plurality and unity. Also, socially, in the politics of global justice, Isaiah 40 onwards, it's the classic creation area for larger social creation. I will put my spirit on my servant and he will bring justice to the nations. We take this as speaking of Christ, but the prophet was also speaking of the servant people in his own mind, I'm pretty sure. And certainly the God's people were called to be a light to all the peoples. And later on, back in Isaiah 40, God reduces the rulers of this world to nothing and increases the powers of the weak. This is the sort of humanity that God wishes to see. So, down to the science of the image of God, this is my psychological model of the Samaritan going to the rescue of the Jew who'd been mugged and left for dead. Each of these is a mental process which is objective, measurable. In fact, coming up on the train, I was doing some data on the measurement of the perceptual performance, perceptual achievement. Each of these is an achievement. This is science, hard science we're doing on what's going on in the mind, not in the brain, nor indeed in the language and culture. This is what's going on in our mental souls, in parallel to our physical souls and our social souls, all one soul. We see someone, we see the need of someone, perception, ability to achieve correct information on what somebody needs, is many psychologists now narrow the word empathy to mean that specifically. This, especially if the need is severe, is an emotional matter for the perceiver, and that might be called sympathy, and this certainly energizes action. But what really directs action, motivates it if you like, is the reason that it gives to the perceiver of need for help, for providing help. And particularly if I'm the only person around or the only person who can provide effective help, then it's a very powerful, correct reason for me to help. The reasons are intentions which construct actions. And the intention to help is compassion in an action motivation sense rather than an emotional sense. And the action is altruistic insofar as it's helping another, whether or not there is also some payback for the helper. All of this can be unconscious or out of consciousness, but in acting we are aware of our intention at least. But we might not have reasoned it out. We might not be emotional about it. And we might not really be formulating conceptually what we've seen. We're just getting on with helping. So whether this is conscious or unconscious is an empirical question. Now that's basic love. Then there is shared love, cooperating in a mental task. And the difference is you see the need for sharing, you see the task to be done, and you have a reason for cooperating, therefore, and you cooperate and act together. Here we come to the distinctively human love, which is, again, sharing in a task, but playing very socially intelligent, physically intelligent, and intellectually intelligent and emotionally intelligent cooperation where you take any role in the shared task. You complement the other in your action, and it may have emotional energy in it as well. And so Michael Tomasello at Leipzig and his group and others have said that they have presented evidence mainly from experiments with domesticated chimpanzees and children, which show that we, unlike the chimpanzee, by about a year, 12, 14 months normally, develop a basic mechanism for the development of this full love in action. We play an independent role in attaining some joint end. We choose to act in our own way for a reason that's shared with another who also acts in his or her own way. So an example, classic game with an infant of building a tower out of blocks. Perhaps the task might be individually to just build the tower as high as possible, a bit of a competition between the infant and the adult or the older child. The two might cooperate, the infant and the older person might cooperate by adding bricks alternately to one tower. They might, if they're human, even at 12 months, act complementarily. And while the infant is building up the blocks, the adult holds the tower. And one of the miracles of having one's own kids is to see the kid do the same when the adult's building his tower. The kid holds the base, probably unsteadily, and knocks the tower down, but the intention is there. And this is not this last thing is not the sort of thing that a great ape can do, so far as we've been able to find out thus far. Even if domesticated as much as possible, they check what other people, other conspecifics, or indeed people are doing, and they cooperate, act in concert, and they are aware of what the other person is trying to do and what they're trying to do together, but they don't share in this flexible way in a joint task. The chimpanzee just doesn't seem to get it. A most primitive example, which is the brain is developing from birth, is the mother and the babe gazing at each other at the breast. And it's, of course, the baby at that age doesn't distinguish between himself and other, but it's as though the human baby gazes into the mother's eyes and is looking for love, whereas the chimpanzee looks at the other person's eyes and is looking for food. Human infants and carers share experiences. They take delight in having the same experience as the other is having. they do things together just for the sake of doing it together, which is not mimicry, because they're doing different things. A neat illustration of how the chimpanzee just doesn't get it is the hidden toy game. And when the adult looks at the box under which the toy they've been playing with is hidden, the kid picks up the box and gets the toy, whereas the chimpanzee starts playing with the box, touching the box and so forth. And of course adult lovers manage to speak volumes, which I don't believe is just sentimental by just a glance across the room or whatever. Pattercake, baker's man, hasn't been seen in apes yet, anyway. Notice the crucial difference between Pattercake, baker's man. I mean, I need you to do the opposite from Peekaboo, where I do myself. and play the game with you. And this is continuous, as Trevathan in this country pointed out, north of the border with England, pointed out many years ago that exchanging acts and speech developed together. And indeed, of course, adult conversation is turn-taking in a complementary collaborative task of gossiping, whether it's about the neighbourhood or about science. And teaching learning can be regarded as this complementation in a joint task. So, each of us inherits a brain and a body and a family and wider culture. And through individual development, we're endowed under continuous creation, under God's providence, with the capacity to work with others in complementary ways towards the same goal, whatever the goal is, material, social, intellectual, ethical, scientific, religious, whatever. And Jesus Christ showed this supreme complementary love, although of course that was unilateral. Only God could do that. Moving to original sin, I'll skip over the bridge bit and get straight down to the Bible. Proof text for the doctrine of inherited sin is surely Psalm 51:5. I was brought forth in sin, and in sin my mother conceived me. But I suggest that in context, the psalmist is not implying that original sin is in the genes, not even partly in the genes. I really doubt if there is any biological inheritance, but it's possible, and I can't exclude that. Because in preparing this talk, I spotted that verses 4 to 6 have a striking parallel with Genesis 3, the fall and the curses. First, there are four parallels. I was brought forth in sin, parallels, of course, the birth process, which was cursed with a great increase in pain. But this is a result of, can be seen as a result of sin, that the mother involved in this physical extreme activity is, when the pain is worst, is perhaps not glorying in God's gift of bringing forward a new human being. And so the what God intended to be a labour of love has been made a labour of agony. And the psalmist is referring to his birth being grueling from his mother as a result of not God not being fully involved in his childbirth in the way that God had originally intended. Not the childbirth will be painless, but the pain will be to the glory of God. And a great gift from God in the whole process. In sin, my mother conceived me. The curse on the relationship between husband and wife. The woman had exploited her unity with her husband by embroiling him in her lust for the forbidden fruit, and the curse is that the man will exploit their marital unity by demanding when and how he gets his sexual satisfaction from her, and indeed she'll desire from the partnership simply satisfying her husband's sexuality. I believe the curses are all self-inflicted, and they are intensification of bodily suffering. And this is the second suffering that the woman brought on herself by sinning. But what was new to me anyway is desiring truth in the inner parts. And sin is lying to yourself about what you know deep down is truly what God is saying to you. I give the references there. The teaching of wisdom is the wisdom to know what's evil, but not know it by acquaintance. The deepest love and the deepest wisdom is to ensure that actions are appropriate to our knowledge of what is right and wrong. So sin is not entirely a behavioral phenotype programmed by the genes, it's also a cognitive phenotype. And I've run out of time. I was going to mention some other examples that we're beginning to learn about physical, apparently physical, auditory deficits interfering with language learning turn out to be largely environmental in origin from damage and so forth, whereas mental deficits in language learning turn out to be genetic. So the intimacy of the involvement of the genes and the environment in language development, and a couple of phenotypes, one from maternal and one from paternal imprinting, show the cellular chromatin shaping involvement, not pure genetic sequence involvement in behaviour, and the religion-crime opposition. So the summary of my proposed answer is each human being inherits both the genes and the environment that provide the development for neurogenetic expression and cultural, social cultural inculcation. Thank you very much.
Before we have questions, may I ask if William Cheshire's in the audience? William Cheshire?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that means we have to, only have 5 minutes for questions. Yes, first one.
I'm going to ask a question. If sin has some genetic basis, perhaps, mm-hmm. and we know a lot about the Human Genome Project, and it's essentially completed, and I suspect we'll have primate genome projects completed before long.
Yes.
And we will note the difference in this 1.5% or whatever it is, the difference between primates and humans. What's that going to mean to us as we kind of zero in on the sin genes or genes?
Well, that's the issue. I mean, it's all very fine showing structural differences and structural origins of all this and that and the other, but the science is in the epigenetics, in the expression, we're just nowhere in the medical area, except perhaps for single gene diseases. It seems to me clearly they're going to be polygenic, or even cellular. Transmission is not necessarily DNA code, but who knows what modulation of the gene expression under environment, controlled by an environment. I mean, my story about Tomasello's 12 to 14 months is exactly the same as Mark's story about the vertical and horizontal points. The horizontal lines in vision. The culture is providing opportunity for the epigenetic expression, whether it be cellular or structural, to shape the human infant by a year or so, actually to have the fully working image of God in them, and indeed the roots for misusing that independence.
I guess what I was thinking of when you are too, perhaps the development of knockout RNA might knock out the expression of sinful genes.
Well, it might, yes, but it might need an awful lot of different RNAs, you know, for that route to do it. We don't know yet if one cognitive module of the most specific sort how many genes might be involved in it, let alone in differences on it of it. So I think I would rather not speculate, even if I knew enough about the biology of this, or knew enough about the family culture of this, because we don't know, as psychologists, how these interact in building of the normal mind. We don't have a clue. The science of developmental psychology, developmental biosocial psychology, developmental genetic environmental psychology is only just a gleam in a few psychologists, multidisciplinary psychologists' eyes. We just don't have the evidence. And as I'm saying, the genetics hasn't anywhere near being relevant yet. The questions the psychologists are now asking and can get evidence on and the cultural, the investigation of the family culture and what that does. And that's even more primitive. So these are fascinating questions, but I don't think we should rush into them as scientists.